You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of May 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the people demanding European future, demonstrating we are ready for reform, we are ready for Europe, we are ready for peace.
President Petro Poroshenko's hopes of Ukraine joining the European Union have been put on ice again as this week's summit leaves things even colder than they were. Is everyone just scared of Vladimir Putin, or is there more to it? I'll be discussing that with my studio guests Mary Dajewski and Raffaello Pantucci. Also ahead, in the United States, the hardy perennial of campaign finance begins to stir amid a budding presidential campaign. And with the UK election just days away, can we call anyone a frontrunner?
Russell Brand's a joke, right? Ed Miliband, hang out with Russell Brand, he's a joke. This is not funny. This is about the election. This is about our future. This is about jobs, about the economy. It's about the recovery.
David Cameron isn't laughing, but many are sniggering at his chances of holding on to the UK's top job. We'll be asking if they're correct to do so. Plus, we'll take a look at a singularly weird spy scandal and wonder how scandalous it really is. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to the show. My guests today on Midori House are Mary Dajewski, Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist at The Independent, and Raffaello Pantucci, Director of the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Raffaello, that job title is far too long.
And well, at least there's an abbreviation for the name of the institute.
we should have done RUSI. And author of the new book, We Love Death As You Love Life, Britain's Suburban Terrorists, which is out now. Welcome both to the programme. We are going to start by looking briefly at some news out of Baltimore in the last hour or so. State Prosecutor Marilyn Mosby has said that she intends to file charges against six police officers over the death in custody of Freddie Gray, an event which sparked the latest in a recent rash of protests in America over police treatment of black people. Raffaello, I'll ask you first. These are very, very serious charges ranging from assault to second-degree murder. Are you surprised?
Well, I think clearly they're making a statement here, and by throwing some very heavy accusations, they hope to maybe quell the sort of the anger that you've really seen expressed on the streets in Baltimore. I mean, for me, it's the fact that they've accelerated the sort of release of the report that's led to the charges by at least a day. I think again reflects, and I think this just reflects the fact that we've had a number of these incidents over the past few months, and there's just a realization now amongst American police forces that they can't take time. They need to quickly and, you know, very abruptly resolve what's actually happened. Otherwise, it turns into these horrible riots.
Mary, as Raffaello points out, this incident does not exist in a vacuum. Indeed, far from it. It's a somewhat bleak thought, but have authorities, and I think it's probably the right thing to do, certainly something like this needs to be investigated, but have they raised the stakes? Because, of course, if this now does go to trial and they cannot secure a conviction, does it actually get us back, well, further back beyond square one?
Well, that was exactly the comment that I was going to follow up on, Raffaella's, that, yes, bringing the charges, making them really severe charges, is a response to the response to the death. But that's a fraction of the battle to come, because then you've got the courtroom, you've got to make those charges stick, and maybe they will do. But if they don't, then you're right. We're maybe not just back at square one, but back at square one minus.
Well, we will doubtless have much future opportunity to come back to this story, but we shall move on now with the rest of today's program, which is starting in Ukraine, which earlier this week hosted a summit between its president, Petro Poroshenko, and several of the EU's grander panjandrums, including European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. President Poroshenko asked for a peacekeeping force in the Donbass, visa-free travel for Ukrainians, and additional military aid to stave off further predations from Moscow. What he received was a limp handshake and the half-hearted suggestion that we must all do this again sometime. Mary, is there still seriously the vaguest whisper of a possibility that Ukraine will ever join the EU?
I think if there is, then you're looking ahead 20, 30 years. You're not looking ahead any sooner than that. And it's not because of fear of Russia. It's because of incredulity, really, through the rest of the European Union, either that expansion any further really is a particularly good idea, and that Ukraine, given the dire state of its economy and the dire state of its sort of business culture and its living standards, it's going to take that long, if ever.
Raffaello, it's at least a little bit about the fear of Russia, isn't it? I mean, the Ukraine crisis started in protests over whether or not a treaty to bring Ukraine slightly closer to the EU should be signed or not.
But I think that's probably the expression of anger on the Russian side. I think from the European perspective, there's a sense that Ukraine is on our borders. We have to have some sort of agreement with it. And the agreements were going in that direction to sort of create a different dynamic. But the underlying problems of Ukraine being having massive problems with corruption, having a sort of oligarch culture, this kind of negative business environment that Mary was talking about is really a huge problem. I mean, if you look at a lot of the effort that's going in by the EBRD or by other European member states who are looking to invest or do projects in Ukraine at the moment, a huge amount of them are focused around these problems and these problems of corruption and the fact that, you know, the business environment there is one that it's very difficult to invest in and start with. And, you know, yes, the former leader was very corrupt and maybe a bit too close to Russia in some ways, but he was kind of just part of the problem. There's a very big problem within Ukraine more broadly that needs to be resolved.
I mean, dismantling corrupt oligarchocracies, if that's even a word, is far more easier said than done. Mary, how has Poroshenko done on that front? I mean, obviously, he's an oligarch himself, which makes life a little bit difficult, perhaps. But he has broken up gas monopolies, including the state gas conglomerate Naftogaz. He set up something at least called a National Anti-Corruption Bureau. Is he being, or should the EU be trying to find ways to reward him for the progress that he's made?
Well, I think that he's done even a little bit more than that, because he's taken on a couple of the really sort of chief oligarchs, and he's challenged, with one, he's challenged his regional power by throwing him out of his governorship, and with the other, he's challenged his maintenance of, as it were, a private army. Those are not trivial things to do, but we haven't yet seen whether they've actually succeeded or not, because the oligarchs and several oligarchs wield such power, and it's not transparent power, so that even if you take away, as it were, the trappings and the structures, you haven't necessarily taken away the phenomenon. And the second thing I would say is that it's not just because maybe it looks to the Europeans and others that President Poroshenko is moving a bit more slowly than they would like. It's because we've been down this road twice before. We've been down it when the Soviet Union first collapsed and Ukraine was in the euphoria of being an independent state. And we've been there after the Orange Revolution. And so much then is so like now, where there's huge hopes, huge aspirations, resolutions to do away with corruption. And look where it took everybody. That's why there's this enormous amount of scepticism and caution.
Raffaello, is it possible or at least arguable that, not that the EU would ever admit such a thing in a billion years, but that they actually at this point kind of want the same thing from Ukraine as Russia does, i.e. a buffer zone?
Well, I don't know if I'd necessarily go that far. I think for the European Union, it's always perceived that Ukraine has been one of these big countries. I mean, after we saw the last raft of European expansion that sort of took us up to Ukraine's borders, there was a big discussion, okay, well, is the next gulp to go to Ukraine? And the realization was that it's just always going to be very difficult, not only because of these sort of corrupt issues we're seeing, but also because it's actually quite an undeveloped economy. And what happens within the EU is when countries join is suddenly then they have to bring their economies and their sort of infrastructure up to a certain standard, and that requires investment from the rest. So it's like a huge injection of currency that you got to put in. Whether it's a sort of buffer zone with Russia, I mean, I think that's something that you very much hear from Moscow. I think from most European capitals, they don't necessarily feel the need for this kind of buffer zone. I think the problems that you're seeing with Russia are ones that, you know, even if you have a sort of buffer zone, it's not necessarily clear that it's really going to protect you in some ways, because Russia seems quite happy to sort of overstretch these things and go right up to our borders. You can look at the bombers that have been sort of going up and down the channel, or you can look at some of the cyber attacks that have been under play. I don't necessarily know that a sort of physical buffer is necessary between you and Russia for the Russians to cause problems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that Europe is actually after a buffer zone, even if Russia maybe says that that's what it would like. I don't think they share that view, but I do think that Europe has a very clear idea of what it does not want in Ukraine. And what it doesn't want in Ukraine is a war zone. And that is one of the main reasons why it turned down at the summit the past week a supposed border force or security force to patrol the Donbas, because they fear that that would prompt renewed action from Russia. That may be wrong. Russia might actually welcome some sort of strong, and maybe many would see it perhaps as better, more neutral, more neutrally inclined than a Russian-backed force would be. But I think to put it in there right now could be seen as inflammatory. And as I say, what the Europeans do not want Ukraine to become is any more of a war zone than it already is.
Mm. Yeah, on that subject, Raffaello, as Mary was saying, and as we were saying at the top of this item, one of the things that Poroshenko wanted was some species of peacekeeping force in the Donbass. Is there anything to be actually said for that idea at this point, or, as Mary suggests, might it actually make things worse?
I mean, it's very difficult to see how it could be put in such a way that wouldn't exacerbate the situation as it is. I mean, the Russians, for one thing, see what's happening in Donbass as a hugely emotional issue. And if you suddenly see injected into that European forces or some sort of an external force like this, they will see it in much the same light as they saw when Ukraine and other powers became NATO Partnership for Peace members. They'll see it as encroachment on their territory, and a territory that they've now invested a lot of blood and treasure into. So I think to put that in right now would probably, and especially at the sort of call of Petro Poroshenko, you know, the sort of government of the regime that they're currently having huge issues with, it would be seen as something that the EU or whoever was doing in advance of them, and would therefore be seen as hostile, and the Russians would react negatively to it. Would such a force be a good idea? I mean, it could be in the longer term, but I think the situation on the ground is far too febrile at the moment. And I think the injection of more soldiers of any sort is frankly only going to make it worse.
Just a final thought on this, Mary. Poroshenko asked for a bunch of things which the EU seems increasingly unlikely to give him. What is, from Poroshenko's point of view, who is a man in an extraordinarily difficult and delicate position, what would be a reasonable request for him to the EU in terms of what help and assistance they can, I guess, lend him without inflaming Moscow even further?
Well, I think, as it were, a reasonable request that would be seen as reasonable from both sides would be for a bit more money, and for offering greater, or at least that any new money should come with even more conditions than are attached to the money at the moment. Because what Poroshenko needs to do is to prove that this time Ukraine is absolutely serious about building on the capital that Europe is injecting, that it's not going to squander it, that it's not going to go into the pockets of corrupt oligarchs, and that Ukraine has a chance of reforming and settling down and becoming a stable country.
I mean, I think there's something very important here, which is if you look at it, Europe has a lot of basket case countries it's trying to deal with at the moment. And there's huge political ramifications at home for these. You look at what's happening in Greece. You look at what's happening in some of the southern countries. You know, it's just to have another big country like this that European leaders are going to say, yeah, we'll take responsibility for this one, while there's, you know, austerity at home is just not really politically going to fly.
I think where Poroshenko got the tone completely wrong was when he appears to have made some remark that says, well, you're giving Greece X amount of money and you're giving us a tiny fraction of that. Now, this ignores the gigantic fact that Ukraine is not in the European Union and it's not in the euro. You cannot make that point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move along to the United States, where it's generally assumed, I think, that Hillary Clinton only needs to stay alive another year or so to win the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. And most bookmakers are barely taking bets on her winning the White House next November. Nevertheless, she's leaving nothing to chance on the money front. She's already begun hosting fundraising events, and well, she might. Barack Obama was also a warm favorite in 2012 and still spent just short of $1 billion on his re-election. Raffaello, this perennial question came up before the Supreme Court early last year about whether campaign spending was, you know, a variation of free speech and therefore protected under the First Amendment. The Supreme Court sort of decided that yes, it is, but within some limits. Is it fair enough? Should people who've got that kind of money just be able to spend whatever they like on whatever they like?
I mean, it's a really difficult debate to have because, you know, on the one hand, if they have the money and they want to allocate to political ideas, I mean, where's the problem with that? But the problem is when you're looking at some of the amounts of money that are being allocated and the sort of game-changing nature of these sorts of things, it's, you know, it's very hard not to make some sort of a link and think, well, there must be some legislation to protect against it. I thought there was an interesting thing this week where I noticed that Bernie Sanders, the I think he's from Vermont or New Hampshire.
Vermont,
right? Right, he's a senator from Vermont, and he announced his candidacy for the presidency on the Democratic side.
We all wish him luck.
You know, and power to him. It's just like, this is the winner, you know? I mean, Hillary, beware. But they listed his sort of top donors over the past few years. And his top donor was like one of the unions, which had given $90,000 at some point. And they put that up against Hillary Clinton's, whose top 10, you know, what was it, 18 of her top 20 donors were banks who'd each given, you know, just shy of $1 million. You know, and you just look at those numbers, you think, well, of course, Bernie Sanders is never going to stand a chance. And yet, if you look at where all his money's coming from, this is coming from unions, trade unions, which are represented by people with dues. So it's a much bigger and wider base. And yet, when we look at those, we laugh at Bernie Sanders as a candidate and we say Hillary's clearly going to swing. And that does have to make you think a little bit.
I mean, Mary, there is an ancient political wisdom, and it sounds like an Americanism, which holds that, you know, you dance with who brung you. So there's a certain assumption that large corporations, banks, etc., and indeed even trade unions donate money because they're expecting something in return. But we do accept the fact that individual people may just donate money out of just pure-hearted principle because they like that candidate and want them to win and don't really expect anything in return, is it? Is it being woefully Pollyanna-ish to suggest that the same might be possible of banks, billionaires and trade unions?
Well, it might be, but it also has to be said that banks, billionaires and trade unions often spread their money around. So they hedge their bets. They don't just donate to one party or one candidate.
True enough.
They're donating to a whole selection. And, I mean, you could, if you wanted to be devil's advocate, which I don't especially want to do, but the American system is such that the money follows the candidate. And so if one candidate or other were going to shine in a spectacular way that wasn't envisaged at the very beginning of the campaign, and you can look at the example of Obama and Hillary last time around for that, then the money moves with the campaign performance. So although you need this colossal amount of money as a qualification even to think about running, it does actually, whether the money continues to flow depends on how plausible you're seen as a candidate.
On that front, though, Raffaello, it occurs to me sometimes that the money that a candidate can attract and that a campaign has, it sometimes becomes an end in itself. They're not actually, though I'm sure the money is useful for campaigning, it's actually a thing to boast about, that we've raised this much money because this is how plausible a candidate we are.
Well, exactly. It's a sort of self-fulfilling cycle, right? If I've raised this many billions, then gosh, look how many people are throwing their weight behind me, which means I must be the most credible candidate around. So therefore you go. But I mean, in some ways, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama last time around showed how that could be upended, because she was clearly far and away, you know, the most plausible candidate in monetary terms. Yet Obama was able to overturn that through his sort of force of personality, which kind of switched the equation as in much the same way that Mary was describing. But you know, I think that the issue here in some ways about all the money around these things that I worry about is, you know, there's clearly a whole industry that's developed around this, you know, and I think there's a huge amount of profit. I mean, when you're talking billions of dollars being pumped into these campaigns, I mean, those billions aren't just getting sort of thrown into the toilet. I mean, they're actually getting spent on stuff.
Well, now, in the case of Bernie Sanders, you could argue.
Yes, well, some campaigns are more credible than others, let's say. But, you know, nonetheless, the money is being spent on political campaigns, on councillors and, you know, on TV advertising, all these other things. And there's a whole sort of cottage industry which has sprung up around it. And, you know, one wonders if there's some way of maybe making that cheaper or maybe controlling all of that, you might actually be able to control the spend a little bit more at the other end because less money would be needed from these campaigns.
Now, Mary, that does prompt the inevitable question of, is there really anything to be done about this? The idea of publicly funding political parties, which it seems an unimaginable sell in America.
I don't think Americans are ever, ever, ever going to go for that. I was based in Washington in the late 90s, and there were all sorts of attempts at what they called campaign finance reform. And in a way, the verdict at the Supreme Court is the culmination of that enormously long process of arguing about it. But I don't think you're going to see that. I mean, to me, you know, it's a companion of the lobbying system in America. And to me, as a European, the lobbying system in America is basically legalized bribery. And I think the elections are really very similar mirrors of that.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mary Dujewski and Raffaello Pantucci. When we return, we will be asking who might be running Britain this time next week and ask whether spy scandals are scandalous or merely people pretending to be scandalised.
There's a brand new show on Monocle 24, The Big Interview, our bold new series featuring in-depth interviews with inspirational names in global politics, business, culture and design. Hosted by our senior editors, it brings you unique one-on-one discussions with fascinating characters as we find out what makes them tick. Tune in every Sunday at 9 a.m. London time to hear Monocle's insights into some of the sharpest minds shaping our world today. This week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck meets Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Lindsay Addario.
In those moments when I am looking death in the eye, I ask myself repeatedly, why can I not turn away from this story? And I just kept going back to Iraq, to Afghanistan, at the expense of my life.
That's The Big Interview with Lindsay Addario this Sunday, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dujewski and Raffaello Pantucci. Now, this time next week, unless the polls are hilariously mistaken, a possibility we will consider, Westminster offices full of sleep-deprived politicians will be echoing to the sound of rattling abacuses as the two plausible next prime ministers of the United Kingdom try to corral sufficient numbers to form a government. First question, Mary, is there any chance at all, do you think, of a 1992 variety upset for the incumbent? Because I can remember that. I can remember a room full of frankly distraught people at about 3 o'clock in the morning going, what?
Well, I can remember it similarly because I was actually based in Moscow, and for the first time there was a party at the British Embassy for expats and British voters to listen as the results came in. And as you say, sort of waves of horror went through the hall. But I have the distinction then in that I won the sweepstake on what the figures were going to be. So I did actually
having
think
established
that they
ourselves,
were going to return.
Having established yourself as this studio's resident oracle, Mary, is there any chance? Could Cameron just be returned with a majority?
Well, before the campaign started, I actually thought that Cameron had a pretty good chance of getting an overall majority. Maybe not a hugely convincing one, but an overall majority. Then it seemed to me that over the last three weeks, he's completely mishandled the campaign. It's been a disaster. And I think he's lost points. Miliband, the Labour candidate, has campaigned very well, has come across much better. But there has been, as it were, the last non-debate debate where Cameron suddenly seemed to have reinvented himself, or at least reinvented himself as the Cameron he was before. And you suddenly thought, well, yes, he could actually win an overall majority again. So I tend to think, you know, coalitions and hung parliaments have not been in the first past the post reality of British elections until last time around. So possibly I would plump for an overall majority, whoever gets it.
Well, you can get about 11 to 2 on an overall Tory majority, any listeners who think that sounds like a reasonable tip. A Labour majority, you can 66 to 1, some are offering on a Labour majority. Raffaello, what do you think? Are we going to be looking at another round of frantic coalition building?
I think we probably are. I mean, I have a suspicion that it'll either be a coalition probably similar to what we're seeing at the moment, or I suspect it'll be a minority government. And I think it'll be a minority government that will end up on a case-by-case basis working with other parties. I think Miliband was very blunt in this last non-debate debate, you know, to say he's not going to do a deal with the SNP. Why he had to make that statement, I do not know. It was utterly unnecessary, frankly. You know, I mean, he could have left the gap open, and it just meant Nicola Sturgeon spent today shouting about why is he saying that? We need to keep the Tories out. And the whole campaign has been handled, frankly, terribly by most of the main parties. The only one who has done better than would be expected is David Miliband. But I think if you look before the campaign and you look at how catastrophic his personal numbers were versus the Labour Party's numbers, which weren't actually too bad, he had a shallow hill to climb, you know, and so he managed to climb, but then he's done quite well. And so his sort of personality has kind of caught up with the party's numbers. I'd be very surprised if Cameron is able to win back a sort of majority this time around. I have a suspicion we're going to either see a coalition similar to what we've got at the moment, just weaker in some ways than what we have now, or I think we'll have a Labour minority government who will find opportunities to work with other parties on specific pieces of legislation.
I agree with the point about minority government, because I think the experience of coalition has actually shown the junior partner in a coalition how they lose out. And so it's going to be much more difficult to make Clegg agree to a coalition, even if the numbers added up. The SNP is considered an unacceptable partner for Labour. So I think that either major party would choose to have, as it were, an ad hoc coalition on an a la carte arrangement issue by issue, rather than have a firm coalition.
But I do wonder about Clegg within that equation, because I think he's done quite a effective line on the campaign trail to say, you know, it's mature to be able to talk about coalition. But I don't think he's wrong. I think that's probably correct. It is a realization that in a mature democracy, you have to, you know, this is the system we have. So you have to try to rule and win on some things and others. Well, we live in a democracy, so the majority decides these things.
I mean, one crucial problem there is that the latest polls apparently say that Clegg is going to lose his seat.
Well, yes, that's very true. Yeah.
Before we do hustle down to the bookmakers, however, we do have a spy story to consider. The France-based aircraft manufacturer Airbus intends to sue German intelligence agency the BND, alleging that it was snooping on behalf of the United States National Security Agency, and none of this makes any sense to me either. But if true, this is potentially embarrassing for Germany, which a couple of years ago ascended an extremely high horse over revelations that the NSA had bugged the mobile phone of Chancellor Angela Merkel. These stories boggle my mind. Mary, I'll start with you first. Isn't it just the case that everybody spies on absolutely everybody else, and the only time it ever becomes a story is when someone gets caught?
Yes, and that's the whole point of it. You do not want to get caught. Or if you do get caught, you want to have a sort of gentleman's agreement that you're not actually going to admit it and the other side won't actually make the charges stick. So what you've had here, both in the case of Angela Merkel's phone and in the case of the Airbus, you've got people actually being caught and really sort of implying, yes, we were caught bang to rights, which makes it much more difficult.
Because the other aspect of this, which is also especially good fun, is that leaked documents suggest that the BND were also spying on France's foreign ministry, France's presidential palace, and the EU Commission. But, Raffaello, the obvious question is how much or how certain are you that the DGSE isn't doing exactly the same and they just haven't been rumbled yet?
There are no such thing as friendly agencies, you know. There's no such thing as allies in this world. It's all very murky. I think one of the funniest things I saw emerge from this latest sort of, you know, spookery fiasco was that Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Commission president, said, so this is why we need a European spy agency, which I just don't understand the logic of that, because who are these guys going to be spying against, and how are you going to trust any of these people? It's going to be a whole army of spooks recruited from across Europe who are going to expect to be loyal to Brussels over their member state. I don't know.
That is one straight out of the what could possibly go wrong file. Mary, when a story like this breaks, there is always a certain amount of, you know, outrage and horrors and vapors. How much of that's theatrical?
Well, to my mind, most of it's theatrical. I mean, this is, in a way, it's a few degrees worse, because the last time with Merkel's mobile phone, this was such a sort of catastrophe for German-American relations. And so you can say, well, there's an element of tit for tat really here. Relations have never really recovered from the mobile phone allegations. So I think that this doesn't help.
I mean, we also saw a row between Indonesia and Australia last year over not similar things. Does it get to the point at which it really is, frankly, up to people in positions like running countries to make sure their phones are secure?
Yes. I mean, frankly, you know, I think the only people you ever really trust are your own people, and that's kind of the end of it, you know. And I think within there is the exception to this, one could argue, which is the Five Eyes community, the UK, New Zealand, US, Australia, and Canada, who supposedly have an agreement where they just sort of share everything amongst each other. But even there, one wonders sometimes if that is rigidly always adhered to. But I think fundamentally, you know, when you're dealing with these sorts of things, this is what these agencies are paid and trained to do. You know, they are paid to go dig up secrets and have stuff on everyone else to be able to give the politicians a more complete picture. And, you know, you just never totally trust everyone. Every country is ultimately after its own national interests as the priority. So why should we expect the agencies to do anything but try to reflect that?
Indeed. So we will have to leave it there. Rafaela Pantucci and Mary Dujewski, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for today. The show was produced by Ben Ryle and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sara Mineta. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Ben Rylan is here with Monocle's International Playlist. Then at 1900 hours, Marcus Hippie with The Menu. At 2200, The Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. I'm back with Midori House on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.